Good evening, everyone. Welcome once again into the Pal Talk Virtual Auditorium for another weekly edition of the program we call The People Speak. And this week we've been in a little bit of a whirlwind. Things have been happening not only politically and not only in the world news, but there's been some things that have been going on election-wise lately. The guests that we had originally scheduled had to cancel, but we are very happy to tell everyone here that we do have someone that has come, that has agreed to come and talk with us, and it is Zahir Jah Muhammad. And when we get into this conversation later, you're going to learn quite a bit about human rights issues in this world, because if there is anyone that is qualified to speak about human rights, Zahir Jah Muhammad is. He works with Amnesty International. There are several things, issues that have been going on in the world of late that everyone's aware of: Abu Ghraib, the Haditha massacre, and other things that have been going on that definitely have been trouncing upon human rights. So this evening, the program is going to be a little bit different. We're going to also, as usual, you'll be able to ask questions of Zahir toward the end of the program after about 30 or 40 minutes of an interview between myself and Basima Farhad is here. My name is Jonathan Neal. Basima, are you with us now?
Yes, I am. Hi, everybody. How are you? Welcome to The People Speak.
And The People Speak, as I mentioned earlier, is broadcast every week. We've built up quite a long list of very important guests, and tonight is no exception. We will dive right into it with the questions, and before I begin my questions, I have certain updates on some of the things that are going on. I want to do a brief update on the Abu Ghraib situation, in case people aren't aware of exactly how that worked out, and the Haditha massacre. And we also have a story I know that Zahir is very informed about, and it's a tragic story, and it's about the 14-year-old Iraqi girl and what happened to this 14-year-old lady, and we will get into that as well. So, Basima, if you want to go ahead and begin your questions for Zahir, and we want to both, Basima and myself at this point, want to say hello to Zahir and welcome him to the show this evening. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you and welcome, Zahir. Zahir, first of all, before we get any further, could you talk to us about Amnesty International, how you got together with Amnesty International? I know I have done a little bit of research on your history and your struggle in India, a lot of your writings. What is Amnesty International and how does it help?
Sure. Amnesty International was founded in 1961. It's a worldwide organization with nearly 2 million members. Our headquarters is in London. And Amnesty International's primary focus is to hold governments and now sort of non-state actors responsible for adhering to international human rights standards and laws. And we do this primarily through public awareness campaigns, oftentimes direct pressure on governments, letter writing. One of our primary areas of concern is on prisoners of conscience. So, for example, we've worked sort of successfully with other organizations to feed prisoners of conscience in Iran and many other countries who have stood up for their basic human rights. Right now, specifically on the conflict in Lebanon and in Israel, we're urging all parties to the conflict to adhere to international human rights law. And we do this primarily through research. We publish reports that document abuses committed by all parties to the conflict, and then pressuring different international agencies and governments to ensure that all parties adhere to those international standards. In terms of how I particularly became interested, I did a lot of traveling in the Middle East and in North Africa after my undergrad at Berkeley. And I became particularly fascinated by the region, and I observed a lot of the abuses firsthand, and I became interested in sort of dedicating myself to documenting and to advocating on behalf of those whose rights have been violated within the Middle East and North Africa and in other parts of the world as well, too.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you should say, you know, this is something that I found interesting as I was doing some research here. Is that you have Amnesty International as an organization has a great dedication to freeing prisoners of conscience. and political and you know, ensuring prompt and fair trials for political prisoners. Coming to issues. Now, I've always known that they have dealt with issues of torture and cruelty and inhumane and degrading behavior against prisoners. But, you know, and now that you've brought it up, and I know that you have been recently with the Iraqi Minister of Human Rights, but how about this issue of 28 years of Lebanese prisoners in the Israeli jails? And if after 28 years no one can solidify any kind of a release for these prisoners, how disappointing is that?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, there are cases in which there are incidences in which, you know, oftentimes we are along with other organizations and agencies unsuccessful in our attempts, and largely that's due to certain power dynamics. So, for example, we have been we've been calling for the release of these Lebanese prisoners for a substantial amount of time, but with very limited success. And I think partly that's because our success depends largely on, one, members and people supporting these efforts to pressure government, and two, we depend on governments and international agencies like the United Nations to also cooperate with the human rights movement to pressure countries like Israel to press for the release of not just the Lebanese, but the many Palestinians who are held in prison. Oftentimes we're not successful. And partly that's just because, and we see in this current conflict, where international agencies like the UN, I mean, they were shocked at the killing of the UN workers, but they specifically didn't use the word condemn. And we do believe that human rights law applies to all parties, and that Israel certainly isn't above that, and that countries like the United States should apply this law equitably, where it oftentimes does not happen. And as a result, countries oftentimes get away with keeping prisoners. And that's not only true with Israel, as many other countries as well, too.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. It's just this is so in our face these days with this escalation of the violence. You know, I'd like to ask you, obviously you have recently, and for those of you don't know about Zahir, he has been involved with a meeting most recently with the Minister of Human Rights in Iraq that came here to meet with groups of people and I'm going to have you tell us exactly what he came for. And I'm curious, what did he come for? What was his purpose in this meeting? And then from there, I think we can go on. And I know John would like to ask you some questions about Abu Ghraib. I also am extremely concerned as a child advocate in my life. This young girl, Abir, that was so brutally and heinously attacked and murdered, along with her family. Tell me, what did this Iraqi human rights minister want to see happen here in Washington, and what do you think comes out of a meeting like this, Zahir?
Yeah, sure, no problem. Actually, her name is Wajdan Mikhail, and she's a new minister for human rights in Iraq, and she came to Washington, D.C. as part of, you know, Maliki's overall delegation. And one thing that I noticed in both in her presentation and in other Iraqi officials that were part of that visit was that the message was a lot more carefully coached. When Jafri came about a year ago, it was, you know, Jafri was a lot more accessible, he was much more candid, whereas I think partly because of the timing, the Israel-Lebanon conflict, you know, had just sort of started. That was one. And two was that there's, you know, it's an election year, there's an increasing criticism about the way in which this administration has been handling the war. When we met with Wajdan Mikhail, I thought that she was quite reserved in a lot of her language. What she spoke about was how the current Iraq...
I hate to interrupt, but were you concerned about that? It sounds like you were very concerned about that
garbage. I was. Yeah, I was, because... When, you know, I think as Amnesty International, I had approached the meeting as an opportunity to explore, oftentimes, to what extent is her ministry, the Ministry of Human Rights, holding the Iraqi Interior Ministry accountable for allegations of torture, just as we hold the United States accountable for torture, as we saw with Abu Ghraib. We also hold the Interior Ministry accountable, and we depend largely on Iraqis to help with that process. Now, I think when from her description, what she was trying to do was trying to create a culture of human rights within Iraq. That's what she kept saying over and over again. How do we create a culture? How do we create a value and a respect for other lives when, you know, during Saddam's time, that oftentimes did not exist? But I think what was sort of lacking from her was a bit of an acknowledgement, because I think an acknowledgement of some of the abuses currently being committed by the current Iraqi government, specifically the Interior Ministry. And I think before there is to be a culture created of human rights in any country, the first has to be a very honest and oftentimes painful discussion of that country's human rights record. And I didn't sort of see that. I didn't see that from her. I was happy to see that she was particularly sensitive to issues of, for example, of women's issues, of religious minorities. I was particularly also happy that she was concerned about how oftentimes religious laws might be interpreted in a manner which may adversely affect certain segments of the population. I thought that was really interesting as well, too.
Well, did she offer any insights as to how they were going to be dealing with these types of issues?
Well, what she did say was that she wanted to create mechanisms by which people can approach the Ministry of Human Rights to report about human rights violations.
Mm-hmm.
The one question I think she failed to answer was, right now, given the climate of fear and the escalation of violence, July was reportedly one of the highest months of casualties, with an estimated 1,800 killed in July alone. One thing that remains uncertain is there isn't a climate yet of safety and security by which people can freely come forward with this information.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, what she was talking about was there's a trend in a lot of Arab countries. We see this in Morocco, we see this in Algeria, where countries are trying to set up kind of like what South Africa did with sort of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And there's efforts like that in Iraq as well, too, to set up sort of these Truth and Reconciliation to atone for sort of past violations during Saddam Hussein's time.
What does that mean exactly, atone for? How does one atone for these types of violations?
Well, I think it's sort of like these public events in which people are able to come forward. Let's say a widow may be able to come forward and say, my husband was a Kurdish or a Shia activist, and he was killed, brutally in prison and killed while in prison for opposing Saddam Hussein. Now, what we see in Morocco and in Algeria, and there's a lot of criticisms about this, is that there is no punitive damages. So a woman comes forward and says, my husband was killed by Saddam's time. Aside from the public sort of cathartic confession, and the sort of healing powers that might have, and I don't mean to diminish that, the question is, who then is held accountable for that? And this is a persistent problem that we see in Morocco and in Algeria. It's a step, towards this process. But there's still structural elements of the previous Ba'athist regime that are still present, that have yet to sort of been dealt with. That's one. And second is, certain patterns of abuse continue. So we know that Saddam Hussein tortured. We know that Americans tortured or continue their torture, or allegations, as you see the Abu Ghraib. Now there's allegations that the current Iraqi government is also continuing that. So while there is this...
About that,
Sure, no problem.
As far as the continuation of, when you say that the continued violation of these human rights within Abu Ghraib, in other words, what is really stopped? And is it that the violence against these prisoners has decreased to a certain extent?
Well, I think what's beginning to emerge about Abu Ghraib was that it was not in fact an aberration. That's one. And second is that it may have in fact been policy. That is to say that this was a top-down order in which to sort of, you know, strong handle a lot of Iraqi detainees. Now, what we see with a lot of this current administration is a vocal disregard, an open disregard for international human rights law. We saw in the Washington Post today on the cover story, there was something about how the United States wants to make the specifications for what constitutes a war crime to be more lax. One of them was certain cultural elements. So, for example, previously it was said if you subject someone to something, like let's say you subject a Muslim to, I don't know, eating pork, for example, or being subjected to certain sexual taunts, whatever, you know, that could constitute sort of a war crime. That these are things that are sort of being negotiated, and the United States is trying to push for sort of more lax terms for that. What we see oftentimes in Iraq is the United States, in its repeated violations of human rights law and its disregard, saying it doesn't apply to us, it's created a climate in which sort of all parties have also, including the Iraqi government, has also sort of presented itself as being above international human rights law. And organizations like Amnesty are trying to sort of step in that discussion and say, wait a minute, it applies to everyone. We're holding the U.S.
Dear, this is Jonathan here. You're turning toward a topic of conversation that is interest to me. The news that you reported today about the, as of today, previously secret information about the Bush administration's plan to use a post ex facto, a principle of having the Supreme Court tell them that their categorization of enemy combatants and their process of military tribunals, which remove all rights from the suspected combatant. They're suspected. If you remember Gonzalez's wording, and also one of the other architects of this principle, I can't remember his name right off the top of my head, but they basically said that certain aspects of the Geneva Conventions were rendered quaint by this new form of global intervention against terrorism. It allows them to categorize at a whim anyone that they really choose to be an enemy combatant and basically strip them of not only all of their rights, but to strip them of all of their dignity and to take away any opportunity for them to actually face an accuser and speak their case. And the Geneva Conventions are very specific about what degrading treatment is and very specific about what it is to destroy a country's infrastructure, what it is to humiliate and dehumanize civilian populations. And now we have a case where we have one state that has gone into another country yet again to cut off the civilian population from any form of escape. And now the Israel has 40,000 troops manned at the border of Lebanon. They have 10,000 troops that are in Lebanon. They have destroyed 95% of the bridges and 80% of the roads in that country, and then they tell the people that they must flee their homes or they'll be targeted if Hezbollah is anywhere nearby, and then they tell them that if you do flee your homes and any vehicles that are seen on the road south of a particular line are targets. Now, that is one example. Back to the Abu Ghraib, it is obvious from any kind of in-depth investigative research that this is systemic. This treatment is systemic. It traces back to Alberto Gonzalez. It traces back to the Justice Department's interpretation of what it is to be an enemy combatant. So today's news that there is the secretive papers that are talking about retroactively changing the law to fit the torture and to circumvent the Supreme Court, their Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, where they said military tribunals are a violation of international law. What is Amnesty International prepared to do to confront today's news about the Bush administration's attempt to change the rules, and continue to get away with inhumane treatment of citizens? Go ahead.
Sure. Well, Amnesty International has for quite a long time been pressuring the Bush administration about the very things that you raised. For example, we were one of the first organizations to globally call for the complete closure to Guantanamo, whereas a lot of groups maybe about a year or 2 years ago were saying that Guantanamo needs to be it needs to be examined. You know, certain policies need to be changed. We said entirely that it has to be closed entirely, because we saw that there were blatant violations of the Geneva Conventions, blatant violations of international humanitarian law. Now the case with Iraq is that there is mounting evidence that as you suggested, that it was in fact a policy. What we believe is absolutely paramount is that we as citizens, we as Americans, hold our policymakers accountable at the highest levels. What we've seen is that when violations do occur, Abu Ghraib, for example, what happened to the young Iraqi woman, is that oftentimes there's sort of a, you know, slap on the wrist to sort of low-level officers who may have committed those acts. And we certainly don't absolve those officers of what they did. But what's emerging is that, you know, as you said, they were told that Geneva Conventions don't apply, and in many cases they were in fact commanded to violate the rights and the dignity of these detainees. Now, those superior officers or those, you know, elected officials that may have called those orders, I think first there needs to be an investigation to what extent they were complicit in those orders. And if there is substantial evidence that they were complicit, then they should be punished to the full effect of the law. As Americans, I think it's our obligation to hold them accountable and to see that they are in fact punished. Because what we see, and this is actually very similar to what we see with the current Iraqi government, is the pattern of abuse continues when people are consistently left off the hook for their violations. And that's why it's interesting to sort of see violations by the United States and violations by the Iraqi government and even by armed groups sort of feeding off each other in Iraq. Because as Amnesty, we're also very concerned about these armed groups, Al-Qaeda, etc. In Lebanon, we're concerned about Hezbollah as well, too. And it's interesting to sort of see how they sort of feed off of each other.
Well, a couple of points about Abu Ghraib. I watched an interview recently, I don't know how old, it was a few months old, an interview of Lindy England, who is currently convicted of her role in the Abu Ghraib abuse, in the whole Abu Ghraib thing. Lindy England says that the treatment that they actually practiced on these prisoners after she looked at it when she actually was able to get out of there, it was kind of organized in a way to humiliate the culture of an Arab Muslim, to actually do to an Arab Muslim exactly what you would need to do. For example, the sexual implications that would come into play to have a naked prisoner being led around on a leash by a white female from America, Lindy England. And she said in this interview, after it was over with, that what they were doing was being praised by military. They were not military. They were private contractors who were brought in to be interrogators, who were bringing with them a methodology that is not a standard interrogative technique. It is torture. It is degrading. It's humiliating. And in some cases, it's extremely painful. And in some cases, it involved the death of the prisoner. There have been prisoners that have actually died during interrogation. So she says that as far as her perspective, after she had thought about it, after she did it, that obviously something was going on there where there was a protocol. They were following a directive from the military contractors. And General Karpinski was so in the dark, she basically said if she had heard wind of any of that activity, she would have put a stop to it, but it was very secretive. And, of course, she lost her job. So I think it is true that we have something going on here where torture is policy. Whether we want to admit it or not, you'll have a vast majority of Americans totally against degrading treatment of human beings. And then you'll have an even larger group that do not want anyone tortured, because if we become prisoners, it's going to open us up to the same treatment. So the Abu Ghraib story, unfortunately, seems to have diffused in time. And it was, if you remember, when the Abu Ghraib photographs were being passed around in Congress, exactly that same time you had the atrocity by Zarqawi against Nicholas Berg. And that allowed Rumsfeld to say verbatim, he said pretty much that, you see now, you see what they do, they behead us, and they do this and they do that. And, you know what? It's trying to justify and legitimize this torturous treatment of suspected enemy combatants, and these most, and for the most part, are just innocent human beings, moms and dads and children that have nothing to do with terrorism whatsoever. So I'm really not boiling up to a question here. I was just wanting to make that for the people in our auditorium to bring that to light, that there is a lot more to the Abu Ghraib issue than just renegade soldiers breaking the rules without any oversight. There's much more to it than that. And hopefully we can figure out a way to change those rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I certainly hope so as well. I mean, I'd say there are two follow-ups to that. One is that, you know, with Abu Ghraib, we had the, you know, the fortune of having photographs document that. What sort of concerns me is that there might be many other Abu Ghraibs that have happened or that are happening right now. Because if in fact torture and violation of Geneva Conventions is a matter of policy, then, you know, it leads us to conclude that very likely these violations are continuing to occur and they are, you know, sort of perpetuating the cycle of violence. That's one. The second is, you mentioned sort of about, you know, Americans' response to torture. You know, at Amnesty International, we get probably the most amount of response, at least currently, when we condemn torture, whether it's in Guantanamo or in Iraq. And most of our members sort of say that, you know, torture is not an American thing. It's not the America in which we grew up in. And I think part of what we're trying to sort of do in the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, all the other organizations as well, is sort of saying we need to sort of reclaim sort of this American, sort of American sort of perspective on law. Not saying that American perspective on law was ever sort of entirely sort of perfect, but right now we see sort of it's almost like we're sort of boasting how the United States is above this international law. And I think that really strikes a visceral chord with a lot of Americans, where they sort of see violations in Guantanamo and they sort of say, indeed, this is against the Geneva Conventions. It's also very un-American. And I think that's an important argument to make.
Let me ask you something, Zahir. I mean, under the recent events and the declaration that through our legal system that Guantanamo is not the American way, has it really made any difference? Guantanamo Bay is still there. Gitmo is still alive and well, up and running. What has happened? And is it not true that we're just going to take them to someplace else? I mean, that's the reality. Yes, it sounds good. For all intents and purposes, it looks beautiful. But is it real when Guantanamo Bay still exists? What has changed in the lives of the prisoners there?
Sure. I think that there has been a gradual change in some of the treatments. And indeed, some of the treatment is still appalling. There's actually a very good film that Amnesty works with called The Road to Guantanamo, which is about the Tipton Three, these three Pakistani British citizens who, by a, you know, tremendous misfortune, ended up in Guantanamo. And in that film, you sort of see some of the evolution of the facilities at Guantanamo, and so some of the facilities improving. So that's one. I mean, and that doesn't sort of justify the existence of Guantanamo, but there is sort of like gradual. They eventually were released when there was international pressure raised about them. Other countries have been very successful in pushing for their nationals to be released. Morocco, for example, has been. Other countries have not been as successful at pushing for their nationals to be released. So there has been sort of a gradual, I think, paradigm shift, I think, in how Guantanamo is understood. Bush recently, a few months ago, said that Guantanamo was something that he would like to see closed. A year ago, that was unheard of. So it is definitely a slow process, and it's oftentimes very disparaging just because the violations are so egregious.
How did Ms. Mikhail, the Iraqi human rights minister, address the Abu Ghraib situation? How does the general consensus of that, and why is Abu Ghraib still an issue?
She didn't, actually, and that's sort of, you know, and I think, again, you know, it's just, you know, Maliki's government, as we saw, is very different than the previous, than Jaffe's government. Not that Jaffe was sort of, you know, was sort of a star by any stretch of the imagination. But with Maliki, he's really sort of a, Maliki's been really, I mean, we saw it with Israel. I mean, Maliki came at a time in which he was very critical of Israel for their violations, rightfully so, of their violations of international law, which constitute a war crime. And yet, you know, America's own acts, war crimes that it is committing in Iraq, he was not able to speak to, nor were, to my knowledge, his delegation. And that's something that's really unfortunate. To what extent, then, is the current Iraqi government autonomous? If they're not able to speak freely, if they're not able to sort of criticize the United States, then what relationship then exists between the Iraqi government and the United States? And that's certainly very disparaging. And in Jaffe's government, there wasn't that, at least from my knowledge. I didn't sort of, when I would interact with delegates from Jaffe's government, you didn't see that sort of same tight messaging.
Well, you know, you're kind of saying the same thing that we heard shortly after Maliki's speech here in Washington. A lot of the Iraqis were disheartened, very disappointed. It was that same vague, ambiguous, non-committal, non-informative kind of dialogue. And from everything that I understood from the Iraqi community here as an activist in our area in Michigan, The Iraqi community was outraged by him. They felt that he absolutely did not uphold what he had claimed to uphold.
Well, I don't think it's unusual for anyone that goes to Washington D.C. and addresses the United States Joint Session. I don't think it's unusual for them to read what they're handed, because the wording of his presentation was so counter to the prepared words that he was bringing with him, according to the Iraqi people. It was almost night and day. It excluded many of the things that, there were lots of things that were introduced in what they had sent with him that were just totally left out of what he said to the American people. To the joint sessions of Congress, I mean, it's a very important presentation. A great opportunity to speak your case, and yet he seems to have let down his people, and it screams puppetry to me. It seems to be a kind of a move that you would expect from somebody that's attached to puppet strings. We are looking at about 35 minutes into this program. We have about 25 minutes left. We do have people, Zahir, in the Paltalk auditorium that have their hand up to ask you questions, and we want to get to those people as soon as we can. And hopefully we can get all of them in before our hour is up. And I'm they've been there for a while, so obviously they're eager to ask their questions. So maybe in just a couple of minutes, Basma, you can go ahead, and maybe in just a couple of minutes we can let that first person in line come up and ask their question of Zahir.
Sure.
Absolutely. One question that I would like to talk to you about, how is Amnesty International involved, if in any way, shape, or form, with this young girl that was brutally raped and murdered by the four American soldier, Abir Qamsi Hamza al-Jannabi. Can you talk to us briefly on that? And then after that, we'll start to be taking some questions from our audience.
Sure, no problem. Well, Amnesty International, along with sort of a chorus of other international human rights groups, has called for an investigation into the incident, and for that, all those responsible to be punished to the full extent of the law, and possibly brought before an international court. Now, one of the challenges is that the United States has sort of consistently sort of oftentimes shielded those U.S. soldiers who oftentimes are found guilty of or are accused of committing these gross violations, and that's part of the challenge right now, is that although it's hard oftentimes to sort of get success when there's such an overwhelming response and denial, and almost from the very top level a cover up of what in fact is happening, and I think the one thing that we're really trying to push for is for more information, is for more mounting evidence about this incident, and really to sort of urge our members to go to their elected officials and to demand that members of Congress raise this issue on the congressional floor, that this is something that we simply don't stand, that we don't stand by, and that, you know, she and many others who may have similarly been violated deserve a lot more and deserve justice.
Well, let me ask one more question. Does it have to become so heinous, so atrocious, so beyond anything within the even barbarism is beyond, is limited in the actions against this child. Does it have to be this bad before it gets recognized? And what's not being told?
Absolutely. I mean, I absolutely. That's sort of really what worries me, is that oftentimes these cases that, you know, that get noticed and that get picked up are the ones that are like Abu Ghraib or like this 14-year-old that are really just, I mean, unfathomable. I think a few years ago, you know, if you'd said that something like this would have happened, you know, I mean, I certainly would have been shocked. I mean, not that the U.S. hasn't committed gross violations in the past, but I think there has to be a daily effort to hold the U.S. accountable. I recently heard someone speak about Iraq, and he was very high up in the previous Iraqi government, and he was saying, and he's an Iraqi American who sort of left the diaspora community, went back to work with the Iraqi government. He said that American soldiers have almost carte blanche to attack Iraqis in the name of security.
Yeah.
And he said, at checkpoints, it's just open season. And I said, well, why aren't people coming forward? And, you know, Iraqis coming forward. He says, one, there's no mechanism. He says, but more importantly, people are absolutely horrified. Then you add in the element of sectarian violence, which claims nearly 100 people every day, and people are beginning to wonder, wait a minute. Saddam Hussein's government was so horrific, partly because of the sectarian problem and partly because there was this very daily, very real threat of violence. And that very real threat of violence, it persists today. And what is sort of, you know, exacerbated is that it's coming from so many different levels. And the United States is, you know, which sort of, you know, has in many ways the ability to sort of maintain a certain decorum of human rights law, is oftentimes the one that is setting the example and violating those rights. So I think it's important that we raise up the case of this 14-year-old girl, but not just her case, but there's so many other cases. I mean, no matter how small the violation is, it is a violation, and it is something that we need to hold the U.S. accountable for.
Exactly. And just for everybody's information, the people who are speaking with Zahir Jean Muhammad, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
And our first audience participant is Oh No, Not Again. Oh No, please come to the mic, give us your name, where you're calling from, and a brief question for Zahir.
Hello, Zahir, and thank you very much for sparing the time to speak with us. My name's Barry. I'm calling from Perth in Western Australia. My question relates specifically to one prisoner. I'm not sure if you can feel...
Yeah, hello, one prisoner?
You dropped off.
There's a young man by the name of David Hicks in Guantanamo years now.
Thank you. Oh No, I believe he was questioning about a specific prisoner in Guantanamo Bay, a David Hicks.
Yeah,
whether or
David,
not you were familiar with the case.
Yeah, David Hicks. He's a Australian convert to Islam, and he's being held in Guantanamo, supposedly after serving with the Taliban and Al Qaeda. So now he has been actually held for nearly 4 years as a quote unquote unlawful combatant, and so he's sort of, you know, as when you're designated an unlawful combatant, you're outside the normal protections of U.S. law and of the Geneva Conventions, at the moment what's happening is that there's a a trial before the U.S. Military Commission was supposed to begin in November 2005, but the procedures actually were canceled because the Supreme Court ruled that it was invalid to sort of have these commissions. So at the moment, no sort of further trial has been sort of opened about him. There's, like, as I said, there's a canceled trial, and we continue to sort of work with his attorney on his case. And it's still something that is it's a concern of ours. Now, the one thing about David Hicks is that the Australian government has been working more closely on sort of on his case. There are a lot of people in Guantanamo in which, you know, the countries in which they're from oftentimes don't sort of support them, and he's someone who the Australian government has been working closely with him. What the latest is that he has filed an affidavit declaring that he had been tortured and abused while in U.S. Military authorities, and you can check our website for some updates on that. But we've been working on his case and many others.
Well, Zahir, I'm sure that, oh no, not again, the person that asked that question obviously had some issues and wasn't able to complete it, but I'm sure that your answer was sufficient. He does thank you, and we'll go to the next person. On my list, I see Peace Lover. Peace Lover, come on up to the microphone, tell us your name and your location, if you would, and ask your question.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming on the show, Zahir. This is Mike from California. My question is, in your opinion, after talking to the Minister of Human Rights in Iraq, do you think the Iraq government, as well as the Iraq people, will pretty much explode if the soldiers in the rape case of Abir Qasim Hamza are not sentenced to the death penalty? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I don't think they'll explode, is it? I think there certainly will be indignation. But I think already there is such a level of concern. Maybe that's actually kind of a tame word. I should use a stronger word. Directed at the United States by the Iraqis because of the U.S.'s violations. I think really the outcome of it will certainly have an effect, particularly if there is an acquittal. But I think if there is an acquittal, I think people will sort of view it as, you know, a very flawed, you know, U.S. legal system. In which sort of U.S. Officers are oftentimes not held accountable. If they are in fact punished, if they are in fact found guilty, I think still in the Iraqi consciousness there is this very real memory of what happened to her. And I think for most Iraqis, they know of someone, or they've heard of someone, or they may have even witnessed a violation committed by a U.S. soldier. And that is a part of the living reality. And that really is, I think, what we need to address. I think it's not just about the 14-year-old. I think almost nearly every Iraqi has some sort of story of interaction with a U.S. soldier, oftentimes not pleasant. It may be pleasant. And I think that is what's festering a lot of the mistrust and a lot of the resentment at the U.S. presence in Iraq.
Well, thank you very much, Zahir. Our next audience participant is Dennis Domenes. Dennis, will you come to the mic, tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and a brief message, brief question for Zahir?
Hello, Zahir. It's good to talk to you. I'm Dennis from Orlando, Florida. First of all, I want to thank Amnesty International for their good works. It's always a good thing when someone shines light on the darkest corners of human existence. Anyway, my question to you is, the U.S. has lost the moral high ground by engaging in these kind of un-American activities. Has this caused other governments to believe that they can get away with more without criticism from the U.S. because of our loss of the moral high ground? Thank you.
Sure. That's an excellent question. Now, in terms of the U.S. sort of losing, you know, moral high ground, that's sort of a very subjective sort of point, which, you know, everyone is open, you know, subject to their own interpretation. I think that the U.S.'s violations have certainly put it in a precarious situation where it oftentimes isn't sort of seen as a credible source or credible model for, you know, quote-unquote democracy or quote-unquote human rights. Now, in terms of, you know, does that mean that we've created a climate in which other countries, we've let other countries off the hook? I do believe so. If you look at, again, you know, Maliki's visit, I mean, I think it goes sort of two ways. One was that we really muffled Maliki's voice in terms of what he could talk about, you know, Abu Ghraib and other violations by the U.S. But at the same time, though, there wasn't the reverse happening. That is to say, there wasn't a lot of criticism from this administration about violations by Maliki's government. And as I mentioned earlier, there are allegations that the Iraqi government is committing torture and may be targeting certain communities. So, for example, certain communities, there is evidence that perhaps gays and lesbians, who are, you know, gay and lesbian Iraqis may be targeted, perhaps Sunnis may be targeted, perhaps sort of non-Muslims, perhaps sort of Kurds, etc. There hasn't really been that discussion, and I think largely it's just because the U.S. is placing itself that international human rights law does not apply to the United States, and in this case really to Iraq, and that's very problematic. It seems like the only time in which we're applying these standards is when it comes to armed groups. And Amnesty certainly is very, as I said earlier, concerned about armed groups, Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, etc. And the U.S. is oftentimes invoking human rights law when talking about those groups. But we believe that all groups and all sort of entities are accountable to these same laws.
Well, Dennis, that was an excellent question and a very informative answer, Zahir. Next on the list, we have about 12 minutes remaining. We have four people in line to ask questions.
And okay, I'll be quick. Sorry.
We should address all four people. Doing great. Next on my list, I see Minuet Exports. Minuet Exports, come on up, take the mic, tell us where you are, if you would, and what your name is, and ask your question.
Good evening. Thank you for speaking so openly. My name is Claudia, and I'm on Pal Talk from Argentina. I'm an American veteran of the U.S. Army, and I have a question for you. I'm also a journalist here in Argentina. Do you know, and can you, do you have a list or a number of American people in Guantanamo Bay that are not being held under any charges whatsoever, as far as, you know, having anything to do with Al-Qaeda or anything, but are being held against their will? Thank you.
Sure. No problem. Well, the thing is that we don't have a complete list of those who are being held in Guantanamo, and that's sort of really one of the issues, is that there is, you know, it remains unknown about how many people are in fact held. Now, in terms of those who are actually being held on charges, even that is sort of disputed, or really is sort of it's unknown. We do know that a large portion of people have not been tried for anything. The Tipton Three, for example, were held without being tried for anything, but with any charges. Oftentimes, it's based on them being sort of an enemy combatant, or as Rumsfeld sort of says, it's about crimes that they may likely commit in the future. It's very much like that movie Minority Report, where you get people before they're actually going to commit a crime. I mean, really, in some ways, that's sort of how, you know, Guantanamo Bay has worked. And that's why it's such a very blatant violation of the Geneva Conventions, and which is why we've said that as it stands, it must be closed, that there's no way in which you can reform Guantanamo. It must entirely be closed because it really is a human rights scandal. And it really is probably one of the biggest blemishes in the United States' history. And I think the international community rightfully sees it that way.
Which is exactly how most people should see it. It is a direct violation of all human rights, and I would think that most Americans would be abhorrent of it. Our next guest is Nashmi 11. Nashmi, if you'll come to the mic with your name, where you're calling from, and a question for Zahir.
thanks a lot. Definitely a wonderful forum. This is Ahmad from San Francisco, the Bay Area. I have a two-tier question to your guest there. Amnesty International has a huge file documenting Israel's human rights violations and war crimes. What enforceable actions can the world community at large and the UN in particular take to address such heinous violations? And is the fact that certain superpowers have veto power has greatly diminished from Amnesty International's noble cause?
Okay, so the second part was about the fact that international powers have veto power. Did I understand correctly? Okay, well, now in terms of the issue of Israel, I think, well, first of all, in the current conflict, we have to be careful to, there's obviously a discrepancy in terms of the scale of casualties that we see in Lebanon and we see in Israel. However, when we say that Israel is committing a war crime, we're also obliged to say that Hezbollah, through its indiscriminate attacks in northern Israel, is also committing a war crime as well, too. Now, particularly towards Israel, I think one of the issues that we're concerned about is sort of the U.S. angle, i.e. the fact that the U.S. sent sort of a rush shipment of jet fuel and other military supplies, which Israel is using often to target Lebanese civilians. And that is an angle which I feel like there should be pressure, one, on the State Department for that policy, two, on members of Congress for allowing this to occur, and three, on the companies themselves. Robert Fisk has been very vocal about talking about Lockheed Martin and planes used by Lockheed Martin. Earlier, Amnesty International was very vocal on the company Caterpillar, which was oftentimes used in house demolitions in the West Bank and in the Gaza. Now, in terms of the international community having that veto power, certainly it does make things more challenging. But I do believe that our power as Amnesty International, and really just in general, the human rights movement, is in the collective voice. We had a vigil on Monday, which was held in maybe 30, 40 countries, calling for a ceasefire. And we hope that throughout this conflict that we'll have continued actions holding governments accountable. And I recommend you check out our website, amnestyusa.org, and you can see sign up for all those actions.
And that was amnestyusa.org. That is correct.
Yeah.
So here, okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a quick point before I think we come to our last questioner. We have about 4 minutes remaining. There should be plenty of time. Just wanted to make the an observation today. I heard a story that 100,000 Lebanese in southern Lebanon are currently cut off from the three basic necessities of food, water, and medicine. 100,000 Lebanese civilians. I need to dig deeper. I heard it on National Public Radio this afternoon. I need to look that up and read more about it, but I just wanted to make that point. And it's disheartening to me to have any group of civilians cut off from basic necessities, regardless of the militaristic reasons for doing it. We have one more person on the list to ask a question. It's Kate715. If you would come up and get your name and where you're calling from and a question for Zahir.
Good afternoon, Zahir. Thank you very much. I'm Kate. I'm from Australia. My question to you is that I have been looking for comment from Amnesty International concerning the current conflict in the Middle East between Lebanon and Israel. You have in part answered my question in that Amnesty International are not making any direct statements concerning this conflict because you see there is culpability on both sides. However, world leaders are condemning the disproportionate action by Israel, and I'm just wanting to find out from you why Amnesty International in this instance is remaining silent when you have been so vocal in the past about the human rights violations and the actions, the excesses of Israel against the Palestinians and the Lebanese. Thank you.
Sure. It's an excellent question. Well, I would say that, you know, Amnesty International throughout this whole conflict has been very vocal. It depends on where you sort of date this. I think it's very problematic to date this, but if we were to date this as the capture first of the Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah, that was something that we addressed. And then in the subsequent attacks by Israel, we called Kana devastating. We called it a war crime. We have talked about how, as you pointed out, that roads have oftentimes been bombed, that people seeking evacuation have been targeted, and that the argument that is oftentimes forwarded by the IDF that it is targeting, that Hezbollah is using children as shields, civilians as shields, holds no weight, just because that the IDF, there are patterns that emerge that the IDF is deliberately targeting civilian areas with little or perhaps no military gain. So I think we have been very critical. We were one of the first organizations calling for a UN investigation into Qana. That said, I do believe that we can all do more. I think as organizations, we're always striving to do more and to apply more pressure. The conflict still rages on, unfortunately, and there are many people who really sort of depend on the international community's support during this time, and I hope we can sort of all work together towards bringing a ceasefire, and really an effective ceasefire, not just a ceasefire, but an effective ceasefire in which there will be sort of a just solution to this conflict. So I think that it's something that I invite people to sort of join in with Amnesty and the struggle, and to provide your input as well, too, about how we can be more effective on these issues.
Well, Zahir, as a Palestinian-American myself, I know that Amnesty International has been a good friend to Palestine, a good friend of the prisoners in Israeli jails languishing for year after year with a majority of them with no charges being brought against them. And I want you to know that we couldn't be more grateful as Palestinians, and the world has to see that. In fact, we must speak out. That's the key. You heard it here from the voice of Amnesty International via Zahir Jean Mohammed, and we need to continue to call out and bring these people, demand that our governments adhere to international policy. Demand. Again, we want to thank you this evening for being with us, Zahid.
Thank you so much.
The audience has just been just going crazy here in our virtual auditorium. They absolutely love you. They are very pleased with the responses and the questions that you've given.
I think they were excellent questions. Yeah. Excellent questions from our guests in the room tonight, I think. We do have a couple of minutes left for closing comments. If Basimo, you can point Zahir in that direction when he's ready. If we want to make a closing comment on tonight's program, we are going to call the program in about 2 minutes. We're going to go ahead and close the program. So, if you want to make some closing comments to the Paltapalt guests now and the future guests on our archive recorded version of this program, there will be people who will be listening. So, if you want to. Basma, just lead into that, and then we can call it a night after that.
Absolutely. Zahir, in the end result, what do you want people to know about Amnesty International, and what do you want the people to know about what is happening in the world, and how can we change it?
Sure. Well, the one thing I'd like to stress about Amnesty, which I think makes it unique, is that we are a membership-driven organization. We really depend on the members. Not in the sense of, sort of just paying their dues, et cetera, but we really are driven by the members. For example, we sent a mission out to Israel and Lebanon, and it was not staff members like myself who went, but it was, in fact, members. And what I have seen in my time at Amnesty is that we are able to sort of make a difference when we work effectively with members and with the greater community. So, for example, I recently met with a former prisoner of conscience from Iran, and he was saying, and he was nearly in tears when he talked about the flood of letters that he did receive while in prison, and how that sort of helped his case, and during his long nights it gave him a lot of sort of solace. The reason why I say this is not to pat myself or even Amnesty International on the back, but is that I think in the face of such outrageous violations that we see on TV, committed, Qana, for example, I think it's very easy to sort of lose hope and sort of lose perspective about, well, what is our voice in Washington or Australia or wherever we are? How does that sort of make a difference for the people of Lebanon, for the people in many other parts of the world that are suffering. But I think when one voice merges with a collective chorus of voices, then I think we can make a difference. And that's why I really encourage people to get involved, not just in Amnesty, but just in the greater human rights movement, and to sort of steer discussion towards more honest acknowledgement about some of these problems, and so that, you know, people can sort of live in dignity, and people can, you know, be people can sort of have access to the fundamental rights that they deserve.
Well, that's a great message, and you heard it here, everybody, at the People Speak. When the people speak, we make a difference. Our guest next week is going to be none other than actor-comedian Chevy Chase. We are, that ought to be a great show. I'm not sure which direction Chevy's political activism lies, but I have a feeling it'll be a lot of fun. Thank you, Zahir, for being with us. John, thank you so much. Co-hosting. Carrie, thank you for saving tonight's show. And to Mike, who our producer, we are eternally grateful for his commitment in bringing high-caliber, high-quality guests to our program, people that speak out, people that are not afraid to take the action, people that are not afraid to make the commitment, people that make a difference, such as Zahir and Muhammad has made, and Amnesty International. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week, folks.
We'll see you next week, and we'll grill Chevy Chase, see what he's got inside of him next week. It should be fun. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. And they stood there hungry, and stood there wondering how this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, this land is mine, there from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.